it'll narrow the issues down and it'll significantly reduce the scope of the suits as we move forward.
Two communities dropped the bulk of their lawsuits over the new redistricting plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state decision that allows planning for a Cook Inlet coal mine to move ahead.
Governor Parnell has said repeatedly that he would not trade one resource for another, so he's gone back on that promise to Alaskans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough is seeking to dismiss its lawsuit over Alaska's redistricting plan. The decision comes after the city of Petersburg decided to drop the bulk of its claims it made in suing the Alaska Redistricting Board. But Petersburg is still arguing that a proposed House and Senate district in northern southeast does not meet a constitutional requirement. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Petersburg filed one of three legal challenges to this year's redistricting plan that outlines new House and Senate districts statewide. Under the Alaska Redistricting Board's plan, the community of just under 3,000 people will be placed in House and Senate districts with Juneau. The community is currently in a House district with Sitka and Wrangell, and a Senate district that includes Ketchikan. The city argued that Petersburg has closer social and economic ties to other smaller southeast communities, and Petersburg would have less of a voice in the legislature because of the change. The suit also challenged the board's plan based on a requirement in the Constitution that legislative districts be compact and contiguous. Petersburg's attorney, Tom Klinkner, filed a motion to drop all but one of the arguments, and Judge Michael McConaughey granted that motion. Klinkner says the decision was based on the cost of going to trial.
Basically a matter of resources. The other arguments were arguments that would require a presentation of a case at trial. They're more complex and factually disputed. The compactness issue is pretty clear-cut and is one that can be decided based on a motion which the city has filed rather than needing to go to trial with witnesses and extensive attorney time to present the case.
Petersburg is still arguing that the proposed plan is not compact as required by the Constitution. City Manager Steve Giesbrecht says the City Council still wants to pursue that argument.
The issue of compactness, we still believe, you know, is an issue that says the district that they have formed is not to our benefit and not doesn't represent this area properly.
Petersburg's City Council agreed to spend up to $30,000 to file the suit, and officials say the money will be enough to argue the issue of a compact district. Following through on the rest of the lawsuit and seeing it through to a January trial would have required a bigger financial commitment. And at the moment, the mayor and council do not all agree that the city should spend any more money. The council has held discussions about the suit mostly in closed-door executive sessions. Two other lawsuits challenging the redistricting plan were filed by the Fairbanks North Star Borough and several private citizens in the Fairbanks area. The Fairbanks Borough this week filed a stipulation that it intends to dismiss its lawsuit and continue to be involved with the private citizens' challenge, but in a diminished status. Taylor Bickford, the redistricting board's executive director, welcomes the news of the court filings.
Well, from the board's perspective, we had been preparing for trial since the suits were filed in July, and we were fully prepared to argue these issues in court, and we're confident that we'd prevail. But we certainly welcome the move from both Petersburg and Fairbanks, and it'll narrow the issues down, and it'll significantly reduce the scope of the suits as we move forward.
The board's attorney, Michael White, does not expect Petersburg's remaining argument for a compact district will be successful.
The standard the courts look at is whether the plan is arbitrary and capricious, and we don't think that it is. We think the board's plan, in fact, if you compare the board's plan with the actual plans that are in place now, the board's plan is far more compact than the districts that were approved last time.
Petersburg is seeking a summary judgment on the compactness issue, and the two sides will be filing arguments to that effect in early to mid-November. The remaining legal challenge is scheduled for a trial in January. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
The state has denied a petition to put coal mining off limits on land within the Chewitna River watershed. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan says the decision is not a green light for mining, but it does indicate that reclamation of areas affected by strip coal mining is feasible. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Almost 2 years ago, the Chewitna Citizens Coalition and Cook Inlet Keepers submitted a petition to protect Cook Inlet from environmental damage associated with a coal mine proposed by Pac Rim Coal. The petition asked the state to designate state lands within the Chewitna River watershed as unsuitable for coal mining. But this week, Alaska Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan decided otherwise. Ed Fogles is DNR's deputy commissioner. Fogles says approval of the petition would have derailed the appropriate permitting process.
The petition is a way to basically call a halt to the permitting process. And we decided that there is simply not enough evidence to say that, nope, there's no way you can reclaim the land, and that we weren't about to pull the plug on this thorough environmental impact statement permitting process. Now, that's the appropriate place to make these decisions as to whether reclamation can be done properly and in accordance with the law.
Fogles says a federal environmental impact study on the proposed Chewitna coal mine is underway. But Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says Sullivan's decision marks a dangerous precedent.
This is really the first time the state government has been asked to choose between wild, healthy Alaska salmon or strip mine coal for Asian power plants.
The dispute over the Chewitna coal mine has been going on for years, with opponents of the project citing irremediable damage to salmon habitat in the proposed mining area, and supporters of the mine claiming that salmon streams can be restored after the mine shuts down. Pac Rim's plan calls for the removal of 11 miles of Middle Creek, a tributary the Department of Fish and Game indicates as significant to salmon spawning in Cook Inlet. Pac Rim claims it would be able to restore the stream after 25 years of the mine's operation. Shavelson says denial of the petition has statewide consequences.
Because it's going to be the first time in the state's history that we're going to mine through 11 miles of a salmon stream. If they could do it here in Cook Inlet, they're going to be able to do it anywhere in the state. Governor Parnell has said repeatedly that he would not trade one resource for another, so he's gone back on that promise to Alaskans.
Fogles says the feasibility of reclamation has been supported by a long list of entities despite a long history of challenges. The original coal permit application was processed in the 1980s and gained state approval, as well as an Environmental Protection Agency record of decision and clean water permit. Feasibility of reclamation was even upheld by the Alaska Supreme Court. The 2010 petition, filed by the Trustees for Alaska, was opposed by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Lands Office, the Tyonek Native Corporation, and Pac Rim Coal. Fogles says the land in question belongs to the State Mental Health Lands Trust.
Those lands were transferred to the Mental Health Trust a number of years ago. The coal belongs to the Mental Health Trust, and the Mental Health Trust estimates that coal in that project has the potential to bring in as much as $300 million for the Mental Health Trust beneficiaries over the life of the project.
Bobby Burnett with the Chewitna Citizens Coalition says the petition denial didn't surprise her.
We totally expected that, and mainly they turned it down because mental health wants the area and they think they're going to get rich off the coal.
Burnett says there's no scientific proof that a watershed can be reclaimed.
Pac Rim has said that they would rebuild the river after 25 years, but you can't just make a ditch and expect fish to be able to live in it. There has to be a certain hydrology that keeps the little fish alive through the winter, and it just won't be there.
But Fogles cautions a draft of the Chewitna Environmental Impact Statement should be ready for public review in about 9 months. Only then will final decisions be made by agencies involved.
In no way is this petition decision given the green light to the mine. We still have a long ways to go.
Fogles says there will be a new round of public meetings when the draft EIS is published. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tracking down fish fraud in the Pacific Northwest.
Quite honestly, all this stuff is always about the money, always about the bottom line.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The investigation into the sinking of the fishing vessel Katmai is officially over. The National Transportation Safety Board released their report on the disaster, and it concluded that the boat had a number of stability problems that made it unable to withstand extreme storm conditions in the Bering Sea. As a result, 7 lives were lost when the head and gut vessel flooded in 2008. The marine accident brief stitches together testimony from the 4 survivors who were aboard the 73-foot boat. At the time of the sinking, the Katmai was traveling through Amchitka Pass, about 120 miles west of Adak. It was heading toward Unalaska with 120,000 pounds of frozen cod when a severe storm hit. The Katmai lost its ability to steer, and the boat started taking in water just before midnight on October 21, 2008. The skipper called for an evacuation of the boat shortly after that. One of the 11 crew members is believed to have gone down with the ship. 6 others were lost when the 2 life rafts rolled in rough seas. The 4 survivors were ultimately rescued by the Coast Guard more than 15 hours after the sinking. The National Transportation Safety Board came to many of the same conclusions that the Coast Guard reached during their investigation. They found that the probable cause of the sinking was that watertight doors were left open, and the vessel was carrying twice the recommended amount of cod. Some seafood sold in the Pacific Northwest isn't what it seems. Mislabeled fish is more common than you might think, according to the few cops trying to make sure you get the species you paid for. Now those who are on patrol are looking for higher penalties to deter fish cheaters. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Seattle.
Washington Fish and Wildlife Officer Eric Olson trained to become a game warden, but his job has also turned him into a seafood connoisseur.
Yeah, see that spot pattern?
Uh-huh.
See how it's just one after another? See that? It's just...
Like a corn?
Yeah, that is not...
On a recent morning, Olson drops in unannounced at the seafood counters of half a dozen stores and markets in Seattle.
Right.
He's on the lookout for misbranded fish, which he can sometimes spot with the naked eye. Other times, it takes a lot more sleuthing.
It's kind of hard when it doesn't have the head on it and everything else.
Funny business on the label is also a tip-off. At an Asian market, the manager gets a gentle scolding for omissions.
I know that it's probably farm-raised, okay, Atlantic salmon, but you need to actually say that on there.
Oh,
okay.
So say on the label, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, on the label that actually, so the consumer can make an informed decision.
Olson could write a ticket, but the contrite manager gets off with a verbal warning. The officer saves his ire for bigger fish, you might say.
Quite honestly, all this stuff is always about the money. It's always about the bottom line.
The ill-gotten profit comes from misbranding farmed salmon as more expensive wild-caught, or swapping among species, say, sockeye for king, or a switcheroo like cheap imported Greenland turbot for Pacific halibut. Those are all examples of ripoffs that state or federal agents have busted in this region.
Can you get the manager for me?
Olson figures about 15% of seafood in the marketplace is masquerading as something other than what it actually is. His is in the middle range of various estimates. For the past 3 years, a University of Washington Tacoma environmental scientist has assigned students to run DNA tests on salmon sold at retail and in South Puget Sound restaurants. Professor Erica Klein says more than a third, 38% of the restaurant samples came back as a different species than what the menu said.
So that was the really high shocker.
By contrast, Klein says the vast majority of tested grocery stores were honest.
You know, there could be a number of things going on there. I think grocery stores probably are mostly larger chains. and are pretty heavily scrutinized.
Klein says once a fillet is cooked and sauced in a restaurant, it's hard to prove fraud without a DNA test. Klein says when she dines out, she asks about where the fish came from. If she gets a dodgy answer, she orders something else. In Washington State, the deputy chief of the Fish and Wildlife Police is looking for a legislator who will champion higher penalties. Mike Sensi says seafood mislabeling is currently a misdemeanor with a maximum $200 fine for the first offense.
If you're at a retail level and you've got a mislabeled package or two, that might be enough deterrent. But if you're dealing in tens of thousands of dollars in seafood products, major fraud involved there, that would more than be the cost of doing business. That's not a disincentive to discontinue that kind of practice or fraud.
The feds will sometimes throw the book at big-time bait-and-switchers. Sensi separately has to stave off budget cuts to the few cops on this beat. In Salem, a state police lieutenant says Oregon Fish and Wildlife troopers have the authority, but rarely the time, to conduct inspections for misbranding. Earlier this year, a report from the conservation group Oceana called the national enforcement effort against fish fraud virtually non-existent. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Japan Airlines is increasing its flights to Alaska this winter. JAL is going from 12 last year to 18. That's still short of the airline's 2009 peak of 19 Alaska flights. Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau Director Deb Hickok says economic reasons figure into JAL's rebound in the Alaska market.
International travel has risen in Alaska and throughout the United States of America basically because of the weak dollar. There's one factor in that. For Japan Airlines, as an individual company, they went through what's the Japanese equivalent of bankruptcy, so they reorganized. That's one primary reason why we saw a decrease in flights.
The JAL charters come into Fairbanks and Anchorage, with passengers on the Anchorage flights riding the Alaska Railroad to Fairbanks. Hickok says interior activities are the focus.
The chief draw for the Japan Airline flights is aurora viewing, and then everything else is icing on the cape. They do have a lot of different itineraries and optional tours that they take. So some people go flight singing around Denali, they go to the Arctic Circle, they go to Hot Springs, they dog mush.
This winter's JAL Alaska flights run December 27th through March. The 18 charters have total capacity of about 1,500 passengers. Japan Airlines has been bringing visitors to Fairbanks since 2004.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com.
The Alaska Marine Highway System could be another casualty of federal budget battles. Money used to repair and maintain the aging ferry fleet could become much tighter in the near future. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The small ferry Lacandi needs renovated crew quarters, upgraded wiring, and a new coat of paint, plus engine and other work. That'll cost nearly $9 million. The mainliner Columbia has to have new engines. That's expected to run around $25 million, and the list goes on. How does it get paid for? Ferry Chief Mike Neusel says a lot of the money comes from the U.S. government.
There is a real potential that our federal funding source will decrease, and we will need to make that up somehow, either through state general funds or changing the amount of maintenance that we do or saving money someplace else.
Neusel says the state gets about $17.5 million each year from the Federal Highway and Transit agencies. A state match brings it up to about $22 million. Still, other appropriations come our way from Washington, D.C. Congress voted last month to extend highway funding, including marine highways, for another 6 months. And the program's formulas, including ferry set-asides, will remain. But that's expected to change. Alaska's congressional delegation is optimistic, but realistic.
Anything that's been subsidized
by federal dollars is under a threat.
Representative Don Young is a member of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. He's watching a ferry funding bill being pushed by Washington State Congressman Rick Larson. Young has co-sponsored similar measures in the past.
This time I didn't because I want a better formula for Alaska. And I've told him that. I said, you put my formula in there that we had before, I'd be very supportive of it.
There's also Senate ferry legislation. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich co-sponsored the measure with Washington State's Patty Murray.
As one from the Pacific Northwest, she understands that ferries are not necessarily a luxury. This is not a cruise ship that you're putting your car on. This is our transportation system.
Murray is in a good position to support ferry funding. She chairs the transportation panel of the Senate Appropriations Committee, which assembles highway and ferry budgets. She also co-chairs Congress's Debt Reduction Supercommittee. Begich says the ferry bill may not pass on its own, but it could advance marine transportation.
Making sure we have a piece of legislation out there is critical, so we create kind of a marker that when we get into the highway transportation bill, this is one of the items that needs to be discussed.
The Parnell administration is also watching for funding declines, but it's not sounding the alarm.
The boats will be safe and in good condition to run.
Randy Ruaro is the governor's deputy chief of staff. He says the state may have to chip in more.
In the last several years, we've seen some supplemental requests for maintenance and rehabilitation work, and I think the legislature has approved those on each occasion.
Less federal money would bring more legislative requests. There's about $16 million for ferry terminals in Kodiak and Prince Rupert, $4.5 million for emergency evacuation slides. The list continues. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A revival of a form of traditional sacred music has found a toehold in Alaska. The 4th Annual Alaska Sacred Harp Convention was held in Sitka over the weekend. About a dozen singers from around the state and the U.S. joined locals for social gatherings, a song school, and an all-day sing. KCAW's Robert Woolsey listened in and has this story.
There's a saying that, I wouldn't go across the street to listen to a shape note singing, but I'd drive 500 miles to be in one.
I am standing in the middle of the Alaska Sacred Harp Convention, literally in the middle. Grouped around me in a compact square are 25 or so altos, sopranos, tenors, and basses. They're seated in a high-ceilinged private studio space in Sitka that amplifies the energy of their voices. I entered this funnel of sound with permission to take a panorama picture of their faces. It's 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and they've been singing almost without interruption since 9.
When you get in your car and you get on the highway, you go 65. That's how we sing, because we have to go all day. It's not like we're doing a concert that's over. So we get into high gear and we leave it there.
Dr. Tom Malone teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. He taught a song school in Sitka on Thursday and serves as the convention's guide and educator. Sacred Harp refers to one of several early American songbooks. It's also called shape note singing, solfège, or fa sol la. With roots in England, Sacred Harp took shape about the same time as the nation did. It is a simple and powerful form of expression, perhaps the most democratic choral music I've ever encountered.
One of the appeals of it is that the fa sol la system, even though it's old, its meanings are very current. It brings us to this moment today where we're singing together across from each other. You know, when we sing, we sit in a configuration around a square, looking at one another, not looking at an audience.
Malone disputes the idea that Sacred Harp is the revival of a folk tradition. Looking around the room, I see a couple of PhDs, 2 physicians, a nurse, a school teacher, some kids. No one looks like they're here to recapture the past.
One might view it as folk music, but if you grew up in a community where this is how music was taught and this is how music was sung and this is, you became musical, what right does someone else to tell you that that's folk music? It's like, if you learn to count or do math, is that folk arithmetic? This is music, no less and no more. You know what I mean? This is music, no less and no more, and this is people's means to musical literacy going back hundreds of years. So, it's one person's folk music, it's actually just music. And that's why even we say the Sacred Harp is just a book, and Fa Sol La is just one way to discover what we all discover. It's just music. It's wonderful to make music with others. And this forum gives us that experience in a very, very powerful way.
Neither does anyone appear to be in a religious swoon. The Sacred Harp is not carried around and played by an angel. It's carried around by us. It's the human voice. By definition spiritual, Malone says the power of Sacred Harp is in the moment.
A lot of the songs talk about the fact that life is finite and that we all have to think on that, that we won't be here forever, and that we should kind of look around at the people around us and appreciate them.
I get a bit of a high from seeing this music. It affects me emotionally in a very deep and profound way. It gets deep in my bones, and I need my fix.
The Alaska Sacred Harp Convention meets the third weekend in October. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Former UAA All-American David Registi won the bronze medal in the long jump at the Pan American Games today in Guadalajara, Mexico. The Palmer native posted a jump of nearly 25 feet, 10 and 3 quarters inches. Registi was competing for Dominica, where he holds dual citizenship. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Ellen Lockyer and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Tom Bonsi in Seattle, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska, it's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.